Rhode Island Secretary of State-elect Greg Amore, welcome back to the Publix Radio, and congratulations on your election victory last week.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be here.
When you're inaugurated as Rhode Island's next Secretary of State in January, what is top of your to-do list?
During the campaign, I spoke a lot about civic engagement and making sure that the Rhode Island public has confidence in the election system. And that's, you know, it's a twofold operation. One, to be very clear about how our elections run and how well they ran, particularly this general election. And then the second is to try to build civic engagement through community outreach, education, and making sure that the Secretary of State becomes the educator-in-chief on all things civics and elections.
Back when Jim Langevin was Secretary of State, before he was in Congress, he fought to promote more transparency involving the legislature. Nelly Gorbea, the outgoing Secretary of State, rewrote the lobbying laws. Do you see any need for additional changes as far as the oversight of lobbyists and lawmakers that you would pursue as Secretary of State?
Yeah, I think that there's an opportunity to make it easier to navigate the website in regard to lobbyist registration, and then, you know, any time someone is out of compliance, making sure that that is well known and accessible to anybody who needs that information. I think both Congressman Langevin and Secretary Gorbea have done a very good job along these years in improving that aspect of the office, and I think we're going to try to continue that. But as I said, I'd like to make the entire website more navigable for all folks, so that there's a direct connection, you know, you can go and find answers quickly and easily.
What is at the top of your legislative agenda for 2023?
There are two pieces of legislation that we're going to introduce immediately. One would propose a non-voting member of the Board of Elections, either the secretary or the secretary's designee, so that we have a communication constantly between those two bodies. And I'm on record as saying that I truly believe in the separation of those two bodies, especially in regard to the functioning, the running of elections, because I think the political should be separate from the process. But to avoid a situation like we saw in the primary, where the express voting machines did not function as they were supposed to function based on the logic and accuracy testing, I think there has to be that communication. And a non-voting ex officio member of the Board of Elections from the Department of State, I think, will bridge that gap a little bit. That's one. The other is to try to take the statute regarding accuracy and logic testing and make sure it's updated for this technology. There are regs that have been drafted in collaboration between the board and the Department of State, but we'd like to get that in statute so that we know exactly whose responsibility it is to do that testing and what the process looks like.
If the General Assembly signs off on this plan that you're suggesting, do you envision that you would serve as that non-voting member of the Board of Elections?
I think probably the Director of Elections or the Deputy Secretary of State who would be managing that part would probably serve in that capacity.
Past Secretaries of State have sometimes faced a balky road in getting their legislation passed. You, as an outgoing state representative after five terms, are seen as having a very good relationship with House Speaker Joe Ciccarci. Does that suggest to you that you will have more success with your legislative priorities?
I think familiarity certainly helps me, but I'll approach this the same way I approach my legislation as a representative, and that is I'll do my due diligence. I will lobby the room. I will work hard to make sure that everyone knows the reasons behind the legislation, and then I'll use the relationships that I have to try to enhance that process for sure. And I'm comfortable in that process, and I think that's a little different than what has existed prior to me, is that I have working relationships with the vast, vast majority of the members of both the House and Senate.
One more on the voting process, since you mentioned how you think better communication between the Board of Elections and the Secretary of State's office would lead to improvements in the voting process. I wonder if you support the idea of decentralized voting for people at home. That means, like, say, for someone like you who is an East Providence resident, you'd be working in Providence at the State House when you're Secretary of State. In theory, you could vote in Providence, the voting ballot or the gear would recognize you as an East Providence voter and properly aggregate that thing. So is that something that you support?
Yes. In fact, I plan to go out to Colorado and look at the system that exists there. And these are voting centers. And I think anything we can do to make voting more accessible is something we should do. And so, yes, I support that. I believe in it. I have to see what the functioning aspect of how it functions. And I have to make sure I see how we can implement in a way that will be safe and consistent with our process.
Does Verdon's current voting equipment have the capability to offer decentralized voting?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I know that our machines do have the capability of running different types of elections, for example, ranked choice. I'm not sure if the machines that we have now can be set up for a centralized system.
We're talking here with Secretary of State-elect Greg Amore, and where are you on the idea of whether Rhode Island should have a primary election earlier in the year, in election years, rather than in September, which is kind of late as the states go?
Yeah, I'm on record of saying that we should have a June primary. And that's primarily based on the fact that I think it would enhance voter engagement. You're going to have more people engaged before Rhode Island summer than you would prior to that. Now, many of my colleagues in the General Assembly don't like that idea because they're in session. I don't know if that's a disadvantage or not. I think being in office and having the trappings of incumbency help you. And certainly all over the country, politicians, members of General Assemblies and legislatures run that way. They run while they're in office. So I'm not sure if we can pull a June primary off. But I think as far as voter engagement, June is the smartest way to go and would put us in the majority of states that have their primaries then. At the very least, we need to look at pushing the primary up a little bit. And I know that John Marion's talked about this quite a bit, and I agree with this. And most people who look at Rhode Island elections think that if we're ever in the situation where we have a disputed election, a litigated election, we have to have a statewide recount and perhaps even a hand recount, we're going to push up against the ability to actually get overseas ballots out for our general election. And we put a lot of pressure on elections officials, even now, to make sure that ballots are printed, they're accurate, and we get everything right in that brief amount of time. So at the very least, we should be thinking about moving that primary back a bit, maybe to match up with Massachusetts, maybe a week prior to that.
Speaking of disputed elections, election deniers across the country were uniformly defeated in midterm elections last week, and your fellow Democrats celebrated a very strong midterm performance. At the same time, tens of millions of Americans did vote for election deniers. Some of those races, like the Arizona governor's race, were almost equally divided. I wonder how you look at that level of support for election deniers, even with people seeming somewhat tired of Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because as a history teacher, I know that, you know, I can compare this to McCarthyism and the blacklists and the unfounded accusations of communism infiltrating America's institutions. And the difference is at that time, there was basically three or four significant news sources that by and large people trusted. There was really no place for you to go for your own news. You were getting the same news. And then the broadcasts of the hearings, especially the Army hearings, let people know in real time, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong here, without over-analysis afterwards for 24 hours on cable news network. So
still, it took a couple of years.
It did. So, I mean, we've been here before is my larger point. I think we have challenges because of the way our populace gets information. It's disturbing to me, but I also believe that, you know, what we saw after this election with most of those candidates that were defeated is they conceded. And that's significant because a lot of the denialism is based on the fact that folks believed in President Trump. They have followed his lead. He's a president of the United States, ex-president of the United States, former president. And the misinformation was coming from the highest levels. And that's going to have an impact. And I hope that over time, and I hope that what we're seeing here in this situation with the concessions from these candidates, we start to move away from that. But it's our job as election officials to make sure the information is out there, to make sure that we bring that information to the people, and that we set a foundation with our schools, our colleges and universities, so that that information on how voting works, especially mail voting, how that works is clear to folks, because there's a lot of misconception.
You're a Democrat, so I'm sure you were happy about the success of Democrats in Rhode Island elections last week. But when you put on your civics hat as a former history teacher, I wonder how you look at the wipeout of Republican parties. There are currently no elected Republicans in higher offices in Rhode Island or Massachusetts. Does the GOP need an intervention?
Well, I think it's unhealthy to have a one-party rule. I don't think that's good. I think we need robust debate. But we need the robust debate to be about issues and to be about philosophical differences. It's one thing to debate taxes, and it's another thing to debate whether or not an election was fraudulent when there is no evidence. So I think what the Republican Party has to do is move back toward the middle, focus on issues. I don't think it's healthy to have culture war debates for either party. And I think what's happened to Republicans, and I think in many ways Rhode Island Republicans have been caught up in the national Republican narrative, even though many of the Rhode Island Republicans on the ballot were not in line with the election denialism. They were not in, they were certainly opposed to what happened on January 6th. But, you know, the brand is national, and Rhode Island Republicans get caught up in that. I think it's healthy to have a very good two-party system that's best for democracy. I'm glad that the Secretary of State's office is in the hands of a Democrat right now, but I do think it's much more healthy to have a robust political discussion where there are two active political parties who are on the ballot and getting at least some say for the minority opinion.
We're both East Providence residents, and about 10 or 12 years ago, East Providence faced some very serious financial conditions. Things have improved a lot since then. There's a new high school. The renewal of the Henderson Bridge is making some waterfront land available for development. There's a strong mayor form of local government. Now, what kind of difference do you think these changes will make for the long term in East Providence?
Well, I think, you know, and I always go back to this, and it's based on my roots as both an educator and a legislator. Much of East Providence's fiscal issues revolved around the fact that we had a very poor school funding formula. East Providence was footing most of the bill, despite the fact that we were a community that had significant free and reduced lunch, which is a reflection of poverty. When the school funding formula played out over a seven-year span, we saw East Providence gain in every one of those years. And it eased the financial burden that was placed on the city. So there's that first, which I think is incredibly significant. But we were in a bad situation in East Providence where our city manager was being replaced a year after being hired, 2 years after being hired, litigation surrounding that. With a strong mayor, there's some accountability. And no one can point fingers. The council can't point at each other. The council can't point at the city manager. So I think for East Providence particularly, we needed a system where there was accountability. And I think that's, that's important. We've always known that our waterfront is an unknown jewel. And we're starting to see that development and the work around the waterfront come to fruition now. I mean, I'm high on East Providence's future because I think a lot of those things I talked about, but also the untapped potential of the waterfront and affordability. It's much more affordable to live in East Providence than it is to live in Providence. And it's close to all the things that people who live in Providence appreciate as well.
All right, Secretary of State-elect Greg Amore, an East Providence Democrat, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
As usual, you can find a lot more on our website at thepublicsradio.org. I'm Ian Donis.